So it's really been a pleasure to be at this meeting. I have been impressed immensely by the quality of the talks and the kinds of science that people are doing. So it's the standard has been set very high. I hope to keep up that standard. This is the animal I've been working on for 45 years, and mostly it's the medicinal leech. And mostly what I've done is to work out circuits that were responsible for various behaviors that they do, and then look at how they interact when an animal makes decisions. But in fact, I retired a couple of years ago, and I have picked up several different collaborations. And I'm going to tell you about three of them because they fit very nicely into this topic. You may have seen that. That's the title of the workshop. I have already learned that the kinds of things that we have been doing with a variety of different animals fits into this general notion of how animals sense and move within a gradient. And we keep hearing about that. That seems to be a common theme for what people are now working on a variety of different animals. And so we're getting good ideas on how to do it. There seem to be two ways to do it, to move within a gradient. One way is a spatial one, that is to measure a concentration at two different locations on the animal's body and take the difference between the two, and that's the gradient. The other way is the temporal one, that is to use the same receptors at different times. So now and X number of seconds from now, and somehow remember what it was, and is it bigger or smaller at the second time. Interestingly, there seem to be two ways to do it, to do this gradient. So it can be continuous or discontinuous. So part of that is the nature of the stimulus, that is, plumes in the air are discontinuous, so you have to do discontinuous measurements. Other things are continuous, and the movements that the animals make in order to do this temporal difference can be of two sorts. One is that you move straight ahead, and you take the temporal difference on this movement of the body, translation of the body along the axis, and measure at two different times. Or the animals move their heads, typically, move some part of their body. It could be a limb, of course, but the animals I work on don't have limbs. So I think of it as moving the body, move the head back and forth, and take a measurement at two different times while they're looking at it. I have three different collaborations, and we're going to be doing those. We are doing those with the students in the course. And what I wanted to do was to bring you, give you a little background for each of those, where they stand now, what we know about them, and then give you a sense of what the students are doing the course. So I'm going to tell you, all of them involve worms. They all involve moving in a gradient, and the students that are in the course I'm going to show you, as well as the collaborations. So this first collaboration is with Eva Maria Schertz Collins. She was at UCSD. She has moved to Swarthmore, but we're keeping the collaboration going. It's movement along a gradient of light, stationary light, so a light gradient. Planaria move away from a bright light. And Aki is the student in the course that's going to be working on that over the course of the next 3 weeks. The second one is a small leech that is a stationary mechanical gradient, that is, it's rough. They tend to go to smooth places, and they can make their way along a gradient of roughness. That's with a collaboration with David Weisblatt. He was here last week. He's now left. He's going to come back at the end of the course at Berkeley. And Jianjing is the student who's going to be working on that. And the third project is with Daniel Wagenaar, uses a different leash, the leash that I've been working on my career, to moving light stimuli. So light source that's moving both visually and water waves. And Jess is going to be doing experiments on that these next 3 weeks. Daniel just arrived yesterday. He's going to be here for a couple of weeks. He's sitting in the back. I'm going to tell you about them in this order, and it's sort of increasing order of complexity, both in the kinds of behavior they do and also what we know about the system. So leeches come in a variety of shapes and sizes. This is the one whose picture I already showed you, the medicinal leech. So medicinal means that they're blood suckers. They were used for bloodletting in Europe for centuries. This is the North American version of that it's not quite as good a blood sucker as the European one, but it was used in the colonies when they're first getting set up. These two are related to one another. They're sort of flat and probably haven't changed as much as these other leeches over the course of evolution. And what we're going to hear about are these two, Herudo verbena and Helobdella austinensis. We're going to hear about the behavior of these two, plus this guy, flatworm Deucea japonica. These guys move in an interesting way. They have cilia on their ventral surface, and the cilia beat like crazy, and they go forward. And if they turn, they don't turn because the cilia turn. The cilia keep beating in the same direction, and they just turn their heads to the left or to the right, and that makes their turns. They're actually quite small, so on the same kind of scale, it would be that big compared to the leech that we're seeing. Now, rather than using their proper names, I'm going to be referring to them as the big leech, the European medicinal leech, the small leech. This leech actually makes its living as a carnivore. It eats snails, ideally. In the lab, we use bloodworms, but they would prefer snails to bloodworms. And then I'll just call that the flatworm. There are lots of different flatworms. We've been using them interchangeably for behavior. They all seem to behave about the same. Okay, so the first set of experiments that I'll tell you a little bit about are how the flatworms move away from light. They move forward. It's called gliding because the cilia beat, and they use muscles in the body wall to turn. So here's a simple demonstration of negative phototaxis. Here's a whole bunch of flatworms in a dish. There's probably about 100 of them in that dish. And if you turn a light on this side and wait about a minute, what you see is that they all end up on the other side of the dish. Almost all. There are some retards over here who can't quite get it together, but they all move in that direction when the light is bright over here. The neuroanatomy of the relevant cells is that the animal, the flatworm, is quite flat. It's only a few cell layers thick, and it's got these cute little cross eyes at the front. Those eyes, actually, the dark part are pigment cells. Those are not neural receptors at all. The receptors are on the outside. So these blue-colored cells are the receptor cells, and they send a projection into the central nervous system. The black are dark pigmented cells that are on the inside. And that's roughly the number of cells that you will see.
Is this an image-forming kind of eye?
No, it doesn't have a lens at all. So it's an eye spot, effectively. So it's sensing intensity. Here's what its nervous system looks like roughly. It's got a brain, two lobes of a brain up at the front end. This one is the optic nerve, so that's where this nerve goes in. And then it's got a nerve cord, one on each side, and there are nerves that go across this ladder shape. It looks like it might be segmented because there are a lot of cross branches, but in fact, it's not. It doesn't grow up that way. There's no indication that there's segmentation, that this length of the animal is functionally segmented.
So what is roughly the total number of neural cells and body cells?
The number of neural cells in the brain or in the... Probably a couple thousand. It's a little hard. It's different in different animals and different in different species. And as the animal grows up, it adds cells.
About body cells, maybe 10 times? The number of body cells.
Oh, the number of body cells.
Maybe 10 times that?
Oh, more than 10. Yeah, I'd say 50 to 100 times. Yeah, the nervous system is a small percentage of the total number of cells in it. What these guys are particularly good at is regeneration. And in fact, these spots here are cells that can grow up to be neurons. And the way this has been studied is that if you cut the head off, cut it into two pieces, off a flatworm, here's the head part, sort of balls up. Here's where the cut was made. Here's where the eyes are. Within a few days, there will be growth of all the other, it'll get elongated, and the eyes will actually move forward a little bit. There's all the cells that are in this will reorganize, and some of the cells will de-differentiate and become other cells in order to produce some of the organs in the body. For our purposes, the interesting part, the most interesting part is that if you cut this off, within minutes it will seal up and it will follow a gradient of light just as well as the whole animal does. Right, so that cuts down on the complexity of the animal that you have to deal with, cuts down on getting at the nervous system. These are very soft animals, so they're hard to dissect, but you can sort of blast away the tissue on the top and dissect your way down to the nervous system. So what I would like to do ultimately is have just the eyes and the optic nerves and this little guy tooling around.
Now, how do they move?
Pardon?
How do they move? You need at least a part of the head with cilia so they can move.
Yeah, that's right. So they still have a lot of ciliated cells, and they're gliding along, and they turn just a little bit to be able to find their way around. They're remarkable animals.
So I think that ability is amazing, but what's the evolutionary reason to have this kind of property? I mean, are they get chunked by other animals like this and then they want to recover it? Is there anything?
Yeah, I mean, these are stem cells. They just have lots of stem cells in their body. They keep undifferentiated cells. For one reason is that they keep growing, and as they grow, they add new cells. So there are cells that are constantly growing into the eyes. But in fact, Thomas Hunt Morgan over 100 years ago showed that you could chop them into 20 pieces, and each of those pieces will grow a new flatworm. So they grow a head on the anterior side of the piece and a tail on the posterior side of the piece. And their normal mode of reproduction is to stretch out, stretch the front end, stretch the back end, affix them strongly and then contract both sides and tear themselves in the middle, and then regenerate the other halves. So if things are good, if the world is treating them well, they have plenty of food, the conditions are right, they keep growing and growing and growing, and that's how they reproduce. They cut themselves in half, and you have two smaller animals.
They do have mutation, though. Otherwise, they can't evolve.
They do have
mutation, spontaneous.
Yeah, yeah. And they will reproduce sexually, too.
Also.
So they're quite capable of that, but they don't bother with it unless the time is
there. In principle, they never die.
In principle, they never die, and you could have a whole tank of clonal animals because they're dividing. Yeah.
Oh, but if you just let them reproduce asexually for n number of generations, right, then eventually they should probably degenerate. Because genetic diversity would go slow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They certainly don't want to let them out in the outside world where they have to make their way around. Yeah, but people have kept clones of them alive for a long time. So if you're good to them, they'll stay alive and continue to reproduce.
So when you cut the head, how the head turns?
You mean how does this?
Yes, turn, because you said that the turn is due to the turn of the head.
Yeah, there's enough muscles in here that they can actually turn.
It's good, small enough that
they can turn left and right too. Yeah.
Do they navigate the same way in depth?
In depth, haven't looked at depth. Yeah, that's an interesting question for how they find a gradient. But this has been, I mean, they are a two-dimensional animal. I mean, they're very flat. And all the studies have been on navigating in a two-dimensional world. Anybody else? Okay.
I guess related to that, so what is the natural depth at which are they on the ground of the...
Yeah, the different species are different, but they're all... And there are marine flatworms. Which tend to be bigger and more aggressive, but all of the ones that I've seen have been freshwater. And they tend to be in shallow water. When you're looking for leeches, it's a little hard to tell whether this little worm crawling on a rock is a leech or a flatworm. And the test is to run your fingernail across it, and if you cut it in half, it's a flatworm. And if it's tough enough that you can't cut it with your fingernail, it looks like a little leech. So it's and it is in the same sort of pond, wet, in shallow water in a pond. Okay, so the kinds of experiments that have been done so far are all gradients, and this study by the Agata group in Japan comes closest to the sort of information that we'd need to be able to record from its nervous system while it's doing this behavior. So what they've done is to take a petri dish, sort of standard size petri dish, shine light, a source of light all the way across, put the animal in the middle, and see which way it goes. And what happens in control, normal animals, is that they go straight, and if you just break that into the quadrants, there as many go left as go right, and all of them go away from the light. Okay, this is individual animals being tested. If you, however, inject lidocaine into one of the eyes, now you could do it by removing the eyes, and that works too, but this way you can go back. You know, you inject it, the lidocaine, it inactivates the eye for 3 or 4 hours, and then you can go back to the same animal and see what it does afterwards. So if you now inject both, what you see is that they go in all directions. It's not impressive, the numbers, but I think that's probably because they got used to putting the animals down facing forward, and that tends to bias it. But anyway, if you do both eyes, then you do get movement in other than the directly away from the light. And if you do just the left eye, then in fact what you see is that this eye is active, right? The red eye is active. It's not under control. So that means that this eye is active. Light coming from the back is going to activate that eye. That's going to push them away from the active eye. Right? Makes sense. They avoid light. So if you've got light only on this side, they're going to go the other direction. If you do it on the other side, it'll go in the other direction. Here. So if you inactivate, so it's the inact, they go toward the direction of the inactivated eye. And you can, if you do, as I said, if you remove the eye, that works just as well. And interestingly, if you remove the pigment, right, not the neural cells, but the pigment, very delicate little dissection, say the right eye, that means that the left eye is normally intact. The right eye has neural cells, but it doesn't have the shading pigment. What do you think happens? They go left. Because this eye is now not being shaded, it gets more activity. It goes in that direction. All right,
if you get the same results with removing both eyes as you get the light antenna, wouldn't that be very strong evidence that there's some other light-sensitive cells?
There are. Yeah, there are light sensors all over the body. So they're individual little, they're sensitive to different wavelengths. So it turns out that the eyes are really sensitive to blue. They really don't like blue and very dim blue light. They look like you've hit them in the head. They turn quickly away from a blue light. And that's not true on the rest of the body. Rest of the body is more sensitive to green, and so you can use the wavelength as a way to separate.
And depending on the time of day, you get different types of
wavelengths. You certainly do. Yeah, yeah, and the animals are responding differently in the evening than they do in the afternoon.
But the direction of the light stimulation, is it backlight, or you have to shine light from the side? Because I guess the orientation of the cup.
Yeah, this has been light coming at the same level across the animals.
So if you just have backlight, does it work, or you need to have the light coming from the side so that they can...
From the top, yeah. They will probably respond to light from the bottom, but that's not the way they normally get light. And so it has to go through the body in order to get to the eyes. So it's not going to be as effective as it is coming from the top.
And what's the orientation of those cups, the pigmented tip cups?
Yeah, the cups are oriented in such a way that they're blind straight ahead, right? The cups come around the front. And they argue that the reason why the animals, and they do this as they're going along, is to get rid of that blind spot. They move just enough that this eye is seeing straight ahead and then this eye is seeing straight ahead.
But for this to work, you would want to have the light like hitting them frontally and not from the top, I guess.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so this is where it is. They conclude that planaria use intensities between the two eyes, that there's no mechanism for them to use temporal coding. They use a spatial code for this. And I think the data could as well be on the basis of moving ahead or moving straight forward. And so that's the kind of experiment that Aki is going to be looking at here to try to work that out so that I can go home and do recordings from the animals. Okay? Small leeches. So this is the Helobdella. Helobdella is actually about a half an inch long. And this is using crawling behavior. And leeches crawl using their two suckers. So they have a big back, strong sucker in the back, a smaller sucker in the front. The one in the front is what they actually suck food into. The one in the back is what they use to stabilize themselves. So they if the back sucker is down, front sucker is attached, they just stay there in order to crawl. They let go with the front sucker and extend. And they extend by co-contracting circular muscles. So it's like squeezing a toothpaste tube that pushes, makes the tube longer. So the animal's getting longer, getting longer, getting longer. When it's fully extended, it puts its front sucker down and attaches it. When that happens, they start to contract, so the circular muscles relax, and the longitudinal muscles start contracting. So you shorter, 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 shorter. When that shortness gets about two-thirds of the way back, they let go with the back sucker. They don't pull it off. They actually actively let go with it, replace it down here, and they're back to where they were. So that's a single step.
And how long is that cycle?
How long does it take?
Temperature dependent, probably.
Yes, temperature dependent, but it's four. There are two modes of crawling. One we call inchworm, where they actually raise the body up off the substrate, and that's the period is 1 to 2 seconds. So that's pretty fast. They can also drag their bellies, call that vermiform, and that can be anywhere from 3 to 10 seconds. So that's a slower, but this requires that they can actually attach their suckers. They can do the vermiform crawling through slimy mud, so they don't need to have the suckers working for that.
Do they change the way they crawl based on speed?
Yeah, so this important point, when they put the front sucker down and they start this contraction, it seems to be pretty much ballistic. They're going to complete that movement no matter what you do to them. You pinch them, poke them, heat them up, no matter what you do. What they're going to do is maybe speed up a little bit how fast they do that contraction. But this phase of it, where they're reaching out, that's when they do searching. So that part of the cycle can vary from a couple seconds to a minute and a half, depending on their state and what's in the environment. So this is the searching part of it, the extension part. Okay. So David Weisflat's lab for developmental reasons was interested in having an assay for roughness, an easy way to test leeches to see if they could sense mechanosensation, right? And so they put them into a petri dish. Half of it was coarse and half of it was fine sandpaper, was lined with coarse and fine sandpaper. And if you then watch their movements, this, you need a little help here. This animal has taken 11 steps in this container. The first step, its back sucker is here. Second step, its back sucker is here. Third step here, fourth step here, fifth, okay? So the blue line shows you where the back sucker is going. And that's a focus point. The size of the circle tells you how long it spent at that location. So if it's a little circle, it didn't spend much time at all. It's a big circle. It spent a lot of time there. It hasn't moved for many seconds here. And all these little green spots are the location of the head sucker at different times. And there are a lot more green spots than there are blue spots. That means that they're searching. So this is an indication of when the animal is searching. Okay? And so what they did then was just to take the total time that the animal spent on the smooth side as opposed to the rough side. And surprisingly, there wasn't a lot of difference. But what they noticed was they had very nicely weighed the animals. And it turns out that if you look at big animals versus baby animals. The baby animals are all over the place. The time on the smooth side is all over, but with the adult animals, they very clearly are going to the smooth side, right? Now, we don't know why that is. I'm not too interested in knowing it because I want to work with the adults anyway. David is interested as a developmental question. And so what he would like to do is take these babies and put them in a centrifuge and see whether it's a weight problem, that they're not pushing down on the surface as much. But whatever it is, these are the animals that we're going to be working with. Yeah.
So when their back sucker is attached, do they actively search in the plane of the petri dish by curving the body?
Yeah. So that's another thing that we're going to be looking at here. Well, I'm going to show you that in just a minute. We'll talk about it in just a second. All right. So one of the possibilities. Let's just go back. One of the possibilities is that when they're on a rough surface, that irritates them and they crawl a lot. They keep going. When they're on a smooth surface, that feels good, they stop. And so we could test that by looking at the animals on a uniform surface, right? So on a rough surface everywhere, they can't get off it, will they take more steps than on a smooth surface? And the answer is yes, they do. So on an 80 grit, which is the really coarse, you know, if you have a fingernail file, that's that you would hardly use an 80 grit. That's too coarse. And 1500 grit for us is hard to tell the difference between that and a smooth surface, right? So in between, so at the coarsest grit, the animals did walk a lot more. And that at the next coarsest grit, 150, they walked less, but still more than all the others. But then all the others were pretty much the same, right? And if you look back here, this is the number of steps per 25 minutes. So they didn't take many steps, right? Even the most active ones took an average of a little over one step per minute. So that's not a lot. But it would, you know, if you're looking at animals in a pond, that would put them on a smooth surface rather than a rough surface.
Is there a reason why it takes them 15 minutes to figure out that there is one part they don't like?
Yes. So we're gonna see a little bit more. Yeah. It turns out. So I didn't. Neither one of us, neither David nor I, thought that this was the story. So we wanted to put them on, give them a choice. We wanted to see what happened at the choice point between rough and smooth. And on this big container, they see the rough-smooth boundary once every 25 minutes, right? So we wanted to give them a choice every time. This doesn't show up a whole lot, but this is rough, that's smooth. This is smooth. So when they're on a rough, they have one, two, three, four possible smooths that are close by, and the rough ones. So it's a checkerboard with the black squares rough and the red squares smooth. So it means with every step, the animal has a choice. This is just the right size that none of the animals take a step on top of the same square. They always step to an adjacent square. They don't step over this square, right? So they're going to step to either here or here or here or here. They go to one of the eight choices nearby. And so we can ask them, what do they do when we make the smooth squares 1500 and the coarse squares 80? And what we see is that there's a very strong difference between those two. That is, they 70% of the time go to the smooth square, no matter whether they're standing on a rough one and looking for smooth, or standing on a smooth one, they'll pass up the coarse and they'll go to the smooth. Right? And it's just about the same. That is, they'll about 70% of the time on both, whether they're on smooth or rough, they'll go to the smooth. They like the smooth. Okay. We wanted to know how fine a distinction they could make, so we looked at the difference between 1500 and 600. Right, so the smooth is 1500, the coarse is 600. This is the average size of the particles. Right, so this is at 1500, the particles are about 13 microns in diameter, and at the coarsest they're 190. All right, so they couldn't tell 600, they couldn't tell 26 from 13. They could tell very nicely 92 from 26. They could tell weakly the difference between 92 and 190. So they can tell some of them, but they can't tell all of them. So that gives us a baseline that says what can they distinguish, sort of psychophysics on leech walking. Yeah.
Do you have data to suggest that this is detection ability rather than preference? Could it be that they simply don't care that 600 is good enough?
Yes, we have no way to tell. Yeah, so I should be using, they move to, right? Don't know what their internal state is.
Bill?
Yeah.
How good is their ability to suction on coarse or grain?
They can certainly suck on the coarse one. I'm surprised. It's a remarkable phenomenon. I mean, their suction cups, the way they normally work is that they put it flat on a surface, and then they have a muscle that pulls up the center of it. And they actually make a suction. You can measure a suction under it. But if they don't have a flat surface to go on, they can actually grab onto a screen. The muscles at the surface will grab around the individual wires in a screen. So they don't have to suck in order to make it work. So what we know is that they can put down and hold themselves on a coarse surface. Whether they're actually making suction, we don't know.
Do they secrete mucus?
Yeah, they secrete mucus, lots of mucus. Yeah.
Are there differences in how many times they probe different types of squares of different groups?
Yeah, so let me, I'll come to that after I show you the next slide. Yeah.
So for the sandpaper, there are also fewer particles per unit area.
Yes.
Do you have a sense of whether they're actually discriminating particle size or density?
Yeah, we wanted to try to do that here to fabricate different surfaces that, you know, where you have the same size peg, and a lot of them are the same, or a few of them, and the fabrication to do that would take a long time and be expensive, so we're probably not going to get to it in the course. But that's exactly the kind of thing that we'd like to know at the sensory end. What is it that they're actually sensing? This has been done for people. So people, you know, if you put your finger on, it's an interesting phenomenon. If you put your finger onto this grit or that grit, you can tell them apart without moving your finger. So if it's coarse, you can put your finger on it and this one feels coarser than that one. But if it's fine, you have to move your finger in order to feel it. So you can tell the difference between something here and something here, but you can't do it by just pressure. You have to do it by moving your finger around. And we are interested in whether these guys are doing that same sort of thing. Okay, so this is what the animal's head looks like when it's between two steps. So it's reached out and it's getting ready to make a step. But in the first frame, it looks like this. The second frame, it's moved over to here. Third frame, it's moved back. Fourth frame, it's moved further. Fifth frame, over here, and so on. Okay, so it's moving back and forth. And in addition to that, we noticed that here's another frame while they're reaching out, one, two, three. At the fourth one, they lift their head. And it looks like they're hitting something that's painful because they lift their head fast. And so, and then the next one is all the way over here. This doesn't happen, at least under the conditions that we were looking at. It didn't happen long enough, often enough to be able to see it. But we'd like to be able to tell if they do this, does that mean that they're always going to go over here? Right? Does this produce a bias in the behavior? And those are the sorts of things that Jan is going to be looking at during this week, right? Doing the filming and seeing whether you can make predictions about what it's going to do on the basis of what the head searching looks like. Yeah?
Is it always the head that's scanning, or can you also have the posterior end that's scanning as well?
The posterior end doesn't seem to matter. David was pretty convinced that the back end, if the back end was on something rough, then it was going to look for something smooth. But if the back end was on something smooth, then it might not pay much attention. So it was doing a difference between the front and the back end. And we didn't see any in the data that when they were making their choice, their probability of going rough or smooth with the front end was completely independent of what the back end was on.
So there's a temporal comparison, then it's the head that's sampling.
It's the head that's sensing, and we think that it's probably so if you get an animal really agitated, it'll take steps. I mean, what we would call crawling is just a series of steps without the searching. And they'll do that if you pinch their tail. They'll go with it and not pay attention to what's going on. But sort of at low level activation, they'll do this searching behavior. Scanning behavior.
And why is smooth better for them? Like, is it because they need to feed on like surface that's skin that would be smoother than something that's stone or?
Yeah, so what this, I mean, the motivation for this, where we thought there might be a difference, is that if you're looking for leeches, the place to look is on smooth surfaces. So smooth stones, surface of reeds, and bottles and beer cans, that's a good place to find leeches. And so they like smooth surfaces. And probably, at least these guys, that might put them in the right place for their food, but they don't use this. The behavior we're looking at here is probably not food searching. It's comfort searching. Yeah.
So what kind of sensory organ they have, and do they all over the body or just at the front?
Yeah. So the do I have a picture that? Yeah, let's look at it here. This is the big leech, but the little leech has the same kind of mechanosensory cells. This is about a segment, and they have 21 body segments. Each of the segments has touch, pressure, and pain cells, and they have 6 touch, 4 pressure, 4 pain. And they are in particular locations around the body. For these behaviors, I mean, for the searching, we think it's the touch and the pressure that are involved. Although the raising up behavior could be that there's some painful stimulus too. They have just as many in all segments, and they have the brain, the anterior brain, is actually 4 segments that has been compressed, and they're the same number of sensory cells up there, and so the receptive fields are tiny compared to the receptive fields back here. So there are more sensory cells per unit area up in the front, and we think that that's what they're using.
And for those different kinds of mechanosensory cells, does the morphology are very different?
The mechanosensory cells.
The pain and the pressure.
Up in the front, you mean?
No. So the organ can sense a different kind of mechanosensory input. So that's those the morphology of different kinds of cells are very different.
Yeah, the morphology is quite different. We can tell them apart by their morphology. But do you want to try to get at what makes a touch cell different from a pressure cell based on morphology? Yeah, both types seem to have free nerve endings in the skin. Physiologically, they're quite different. The touch cells, even in the cell bodies, are very mechanosensitive and very small movements will produce activity. They tend to fire very transiently, whereas the pressure cells fire steadily, push down on the skin and they fire. The touch cells fire at the beginning, there's a brrrr, and then when you let it off, brrrr, again. So there are physiological differences and morphological differences. Okay, so just going back to this for a minute. So this is the sort of thing that we want to be able to do here, to do to look to see whether these kinds of behaviors will predict which direction they're going to go. Okay, the third study is actually all from Daniel Aguinar's lab, and so if you have any questions, he can help us out. The behaviors that we're going to be looking at are based on the observation that leeches, and particularly hungry leeches, will be attracted to disturbances in the water. They tend to live in a pond. They tend to live on, they prefer warm-blooded mammals. You, right? So we are the ideal host for these guys. But in fact, they probably are being attracted to animals that come down and drink in the water. So cows and grazing animals. And so they're going to be, if there's a disturbance in the water, they'll pick up, they'll look, and they'll go in that direction. The receptors that they use are located along the body surface. And this is so that's what a leech really looks like. This is a drawing of one. These, you'll notice on here, aren't located there. Those are little beads that have been sewn onto the surface. Those are on the middle segment, the middle annulus. These little ridges are annuli. There are 5 annuli per segment, and the middle one has sensilla on it. It's got little patches, little sensory patches. There are 14 of them in rigid locations around the body. Each of those is both mechanosensory. They're like lateral lines on fish. It's got a lot of hair sticking out, and if you move the water, if you have impact on the water, those cells get activated. And in the same little cup is photosensors. So there are 50 photosensory cells or so per. So there are 14 around times 5 times 21, so they've got a lot of both photosensory and mechanosensory cells. Here's what their behavior looks like in the arena that Daniel uses in his lab. You have a tank that's about a yard across. You start disturbing the water at one end, and here's at different times what the leech looks like. This guy has its back sucker down right here, and it's moving the whole body. It's not just the head that's scanning. The whole body is moving all around. So here's the first, the second, the third, the fourth, and so on. This is the back sucker location. That's here. And then each of these are 1, 2, 3, it's where the front sucker is, and what you can see is that the front sucker goes to a lot of different locations, of which a few are shown over here. So this is a complete picture of it, of all the locations, but the animal's body looks about like that. There was some indication that there might be head waving versus body waving, and they showed very nicely that the scan behavior, that it's better to call it scanning behavior, because there's sort of a continuum. Here's one scan, here's another. These are progressively more complex. There's not a nice division between head movement and body movement. It looks like there's everything in between. So the scanning behavior involves the whole body. Right, are they getting any information? So you now have this animal in a big container, and you're splashing the water up at one end. So rather than having an animal standing in the water drinking, what you have is a little plunger that's moving the surface of the water in very reliable ways. And you can ask, does the animal find the location of the plunger? So that's where the plunger is. This is where the leech is. It's scanning. And each of these scans, showing the pre-scan in a square, and then a post-scan in the purple circle. So before they started the scan, it was facing in that direction. Finished the scan, it's in that direction. And so what you can see is that as the animal starts in this location, this location, this location, it doesn't end up going in that direction. If it's in the right location, it tends to extend out. So that's the level of their being able to tell direction and using the scanning behavior to be able to tell it, right? And so there's a net arrow in the direction of the stimulus. So then, really wonderful experiment. What they found was that they moved the plunger at different rates, and they could show that in different during the life of the animal, the rate of the plunging, the optimum rate, changed. So it's as though bigger animal, they got more attuned to bigger animals as they grew up. But this is looking at an animal in a shallow container where the plunger is way up here at the top. So the plunger is going to be here, and what's shown, and no stimulus, this is the location that the leeches were found. There are 32 squares, and they were found in the squares for that percentage of the time. Okay. If you now start to plunge it, you see that there are some that go there. If you plunge it at 8 hertz, then they tend to be up in this direction. So they're more tuned to this frequency than they are to that frequency. Yes?
So maybe you're going to say this later, but are they integrating the two modalities, the mechanosensory as well as the light changes?
Right. Right? That's what I'm going to say next. Okay, so they then did this really clever experiment of separating the light. You know, as the waves are going over the animals, there's a shadow passing over them, but there's also a water wave mechanosensory input. So they separated them out. And so what you do to get just the visual only, is to put two tanks, one above the other, put the leech in the bottom tank, and plunge in the top tank, light above. Right? So now there's waves going through the top tank, not going through the bottom tank, but the bottom tank is seeing the shadows. And if you do that, sure enough, the animal still finds it, but it's at a different frequency. So it's at 2 hertz instead of the 8 hertz. So they can tell, they can use information from the vision alone. Yeah.
Do you know if it's frequency tuned or is it wavelength tuned?
Which you is could, it I frequency guess, tuned or?
Or wavelength of the wave that it's producing in the water, which you could check by using a different viscosity.
That is exactly the right question, and we haven't answered it yet.
Everybody heard that answer? Okay, so then the
way to study it actually, at least for the visual waves, because they respond just as well to projected visual waves as to actual visual waves. So by projecting using an LCD projector, you can make this.
Yeah, so hard to do it with the mechanical wave, but the visual wave, that's what's going to be set up in the lab to be able to do that. And doing mechanical only is easy. You just turn the lights off, right? And there, in fact, they do a very good job of being able to see it, and it's a broader tuning and at a higher frequency than the vision. Okay, so the question then is, how does this feed into the central nervous system? And in order to do that, they're going to be using a preparation that looks about like this. So I didn't have a picture of his, but I do have a picture of mine. This is what a leech looks like when we're trying to record from its nervous system while it's swimming. So this is the front end of a leech. This is the back end of a leech. Six segments have been cut away, and the nervous system is pinned out on a piece of wax. And then there are electrodes coming in to record the motor neurons while the animal is swimming. So what you're going to see here are motor neurons that go to the dorsal nerve, and that's going to pull the animal up. And then the motor neurons down here go to the ventral nerve, that's going to pull the animal down. And you're going to hear the activity from this nerve. Okay, nothing's happening, the animals reach in, pinch the back. So the two ends are swimming in unison. You're listening to this. But if you look here, when this is on, this is off. So there's an alternation between the two. Recording from the middle of the animal, so you can turn it on by pinching the back. There's an off switch too. You reach in the front, turn it off. And then the on switch is in the back. Okay, so that means that you can record from the nervous system while the animal is behaving. And that's what they're going to use. They're going to use this kind of a preparation to record, this time not from the nerves going out to the periphery, but from the connective between ganglia. So they're going to suck up an intact connective into a big suction electrode and record the activity of this big cell, which is called an S cell. And the reason why they're interested in that is that the S cell responds to mechanical stimuli. And so this is a single recording. Here's a bunch of recordings. Here's a post-stimulus time histogram to show you what the average is. And to visual stimuli. And in fact, they respond much more regularly. They're nicely tuned to the visual stimuli. Right? So the same sensory, the same inner neuron that goes all the way up and down the nerve cord. It's an interesting cell. It has a cell body, one cell body in each ganglion, and sends a process out in both directions and makes very tight electrical junctions to the S cells on either side. So this S cell is connected to this one and to this one, right? And in fact, an action potential in any one of the cells spreads all the way to the end of the animal along the S cell. So it acts like a giant fiber in the sense that it's a continuous process that goes the length of the animal. And so they want to see whether that does anything different in the the sensory input coming in the two different directions. So here's recording from two different sites, anterior and posterior. And what you see is that the S cell, in this case, is anterior first, then posterior, anterior post. But this time, the posterior went first. So that means that the action potential in the S cell got set up in the posterior end for these, and in the anterior end for those. And if you look to see what the delay is, it's the same in both directions. And it's always one or the other. It's always going front to back or back to front. Yeah.
How many waves propagate on the body of the leech when you monitor the behavior? How many undulations do you see on the body?
How many undulations do you see on the body to get the behavior?
Yeah, when they're like locomoting, do they change how many waves there are along the body, or and do the
You mean, in, do they change their swimming pattern?
Yeah, based on speed or?
Yeah, they do. But it turns out that this behavior works really well for crawling, but they ignore, so if another set of experiments that Daniel's lab did that I'm not going to, I don't have the slides for, but if you set up a splashing over on this side, the animal turns and starts in that direction. If you now stop that one and start splashing over here, will they now turn and go in that direction? If they're crawling, they will. If they're swimming, they won't. So swimming, the way they, and I mean, there are other indications too. The strategy for finding your prey when you swim is that you orient in the right direction and you take off. And then you swim in a big circle. And if you don't run into anything, you stop and you orient again. And then you swim in the direction. If you hit something else, if you hit a rock or a reed or something, you stop and reorient. So they don't use the swimming behavior to orient to prey, but they do use the crawling behavior. Okay. And so then they could ask, if you give mechanical stimulation, lights off, will give the stimulus at the front end, do you see the S cell starting at the back and going forward, or starting at the front end and going backward? And what you see is mostly they start at the front end and go back. If you do a tail on, if you give the stimulus from the tail end, the S cell predominantly goes from the caudal to rostral, that is the action potential is going back to front. So the direction of this cell can tell you. You as a physiologist could look at that and tell which way the stimulus is going. Whether the animal actually uses that for this purpose, we don't know. Okay? And that's the kind of experiment that's going to be going on here. And the visual is similar. If you do give the visual stimulus from the front end, there's more that go from head to back, but there's still a lot. There's a bias toward back to front. Okay, so we don't need. I put these in case I had extra time, but you don't. So let me just tell you, one of the things that I find very appealing about this meeting is that everybody here is interested in behavior, that everybody is putting their things in the context of behavior. And it reminded me of the Dobzhansky quote. He wrote a really influential essay in 1973 called "Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution." And he wrote this for two reasons, interestingly. One was that the creationists were making a lot of noise, and he wanted to show that, in fact, you couldn't, that the creationist explanation for biology just didn't help you any. that evolution was what you needed in order to be able to study it. And the second reason was that molecular biology was starting to gain sway. And he thought that the molecular biologists weren't paying attention to behavior, and he wanted, or to evolution. So it was before Evo Devo. I have always, the way that I ask the nervous system what it's doing is to start with the behavior. So as carefully as possible, characterize the behavior. And then you know what you're looking for when you go in to ask the nervous system how it's working. And so I've formalized this into what I'm calling the Christon dictum, that nothing in neuroscience makes sense except in the light of behavior. So I'm sure that I'm not the first one to say that, but I sort of like the sound of Christon dictum. It is the case, however, that the opposite is not true. You know, just because you do look at behavior doesn't mean that everything makes sense. So what this meeting is all about is starting with the behavior and then trying to make sense of it, both from an evolutionary perspective but also from a mechanistic. So I have an addendum to the dictum. And so even then, not always is it understandable. Okay, so these are the people that I've had in my lab over the years that have kept me interested in and enthused about what's going on. That's my first graduate student. Notice her t-shirt. And these are the people that I've collaborated with and have worked in my lab, just a list. And these are the nice people who have bought me leeches over the years. So thank you very much. Yeah.
So you think it's all visual and sensation? There's no chemical sensation involved?
Yeah. So it's probably the case that the bloodsuckers, so it's interesting. They do use chemosensation. They have chemoreceptor. The only place they have chemoreceptor is inside their lips. So the very same sucker up in the front that has the mouth in it has a bunch of chemosensory placodes along the surface. So they have to touch it with their lips. They love the chemosensation of blood, the blood in the water. They go crazy. But it's not likely that they usually use that. But they also like two different sugars and a couple of different amino acids. And it turns out that they're the ones that are most highly concentrated in our own sweat. So it is true that when they're looking for a place on you to suck on, where they like is sort of under your arms and between your fingers and places where there's likely to be sweat and the skin is thinner. So they're looking for an easy place to get to the blood. So that's the only chemo sensation that we know. They probably aren't using that for any distance. They're probably using it for the final, where do I suck on? Now the carnivores, the little guys that live on snails, we're going to be looking in the lab in the next couple of weeks to see whether they are using something about the trail that a snail lays down to be able to find it, because some carnivores do that.
So if they're looking for terrestrial animals that are coming to the water source, then presumably when they latch on, they'll be lifted out of the water.
Yes.
And then they're expecting to somehow come back at some point? What's the plan?
It's an amazing, yes. Yes, they so first of all, when a blood-sucking leech gets onto a host, it takes them somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes to get full. And full means huge. So a 1 gram leech can be 10 to 15 grams at the end of a meal. So imagine eating 10 times your body weight in a single meal. during that time, they turn off all their sensory input. So you can, Quentin Gaudry, for his thesis, looked at that to see how the threshold changed, and the threshold becomes infinite. You cannot do anything to a leech once it starts feeding. You can poke it, prod it, cut it in half, and it'll continue to feed. So the argument is that after they get that much food, they can hide under a rock for 6 months and not have to feed again. Right? So if they get a good meal, they're going to stick with it. And the notion then was tested by getting a variety of blood-sucking leeches versus carnivorous leeches. And they're not just all in one family. They're all over the phylogenetic tree. And all of the blood suckers showed this turning off of sensory input during feeding, and all of the non-blood suckers, the carnivorous ones, their threshold didn't change at all when they were feeding. So there is, they just put up with the fact that they're going to end up high and dry, and they have to find their way back to the water.
So you just crawl back at some point.
Yeah.
Using which cues?
Yeah. Presumably, I mean, if they get into a completely dry place, they're done. They're going to be dead within an hour. But if they're in sort of amphibious areas where it's sort of moist, they're okay.
So again, back to this multisensory perception that
right.
might or may not be involved here. Are you planning to run any experiments where you misalign the sources, the visual and mechanical source? So,
yes, we are. That's in fact exactly why I'm here.
Yeah, so he's going to set up to do that. That'll be in the lab in the next couple of days. Okay, good. Let's go have lunch.